You are listening to KBOO Portland. 1 minute before 9 o'clock on your Thursday. Teresa Mitchell is on vacation this week, so we've got something coming up special at 9 here, but I want to tell you about 10 o'clock. Chris Andre will be hosting Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary. And then at 10:15 on Flashpoints, a discussion of how Walmart secretly uses tax havens to dodge taxes and Haitians prepare for more fraudulent elections. We'll hear from Flashpoints reporter Kevin Pina. At 11 on Between the Covers, host Ken Jones talks with author James Anderson, founder of Brighton Bush Books, about his debut novel, The Never Open Desert Diner. And at 11:30 on the Radio Zine, host Andrew Geller speaks with veteran environmental journalist and author Fred Pierce, whose latest title is The New Wild, Why Invasive Species Will Be Nature's Salvation. But first, instead of Press Watch, we've got Per Fogering hosting a special hour-long call-in version of Fight the Empire on The Great Game. Today, he asks the question, can today's wars and terrorist outrages be related to an age-old conflict? Stick around. That is coming up next on KBOO.
Kick me one of them funky-ass beats.
Tune in Thursday, June 18th at 10 p.m. for a special live remote broadcast from What the Festival at the Wolf Run Ranch. We'll be showcasing the musical and visual artists at this year's festival with interviews, music, and interactions with the producers and participants, exploring what makes this such a uniquely immersive, entertaining, and intimate festival. Again, be sure to tune in at 10 p.m. Thursday, June 18th for a What the Festival broadcast here on KBOO Community Radio. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
This is Per Fogering, Fight the Empire, special hour-long version. I'll go along with Teresa's music, because we're going to be talking a little bit about Russia anyway, so why not, why not? But I think, now this is an hour-long special, because Teresa's on vacation, and we are taking callers, and the phone number, of course, is 231-8187. How'd I start out? About a week ago, I heard on the radio news a strange quote. The guy speaking was Representative Mac Thornberry, a Republican from Texas, who is the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee. And he was talking about, the beginning of terrorism. And he said, and this is, I really think I got him quoted word for word, "We were not involved in any of these places," he's talking about the Middle East, "we were not involved in any of these places when 9/11 came about." And I really had to stop when he said that because we've been involved in those places for a long, long time. You can go back to back in 1949, the CIA helped overthrow a ruler of Syria back in 1949. And they overthrew this guy. They thought he was too close to the Soviet Union, I think, or he's too political, too leftist. And Syria has sort of been, that followed a whole lot of turmoil. And finally, Hafez Assad took over, and then his son rules Syria now, although there's a big civil war going on. So 1949, the U.S. overthrew a leader of Syria. In 1953, the U.S. and Great Britain overthrew Mossadegh in Iran and brought in the Shah, who eventually left office and was followed by the Ayatollahs. In 1959, the CIA hired a young gun thug named Saddam Hussein to kill the ruler of Iraq, Abdel Karim Qasem. That particular plot failed, and Saddam had to escape to Egypt. But a few years later, his Ba'ath party did overthrow Qasem, and Saddam sort of went back to Iraq and ruled the country with an iron fist. Well, the U.S. supported Saddam pretty much from the beginning. They gave him his first big job, and they supported him in his war against Iran. The U.S. also had troops in Saudi Arabia, which is what probably the big sore point with bin Laden, that his holy land was being desecrated by foreign troops. And then finally, the U.S. Supported al-Qaeda against the Soviets in Afghanistan. And this was the bright idea of Zbigniew Brzezinski. And his idea was that at that time, I don't know if you heard yesterday on the call-in show, I had a very interesting discussion with Zahir Wahab about Afghanistan. He's just come back from there. He'll be going back to Afghanistan soon. And you know, back in those days, Afghanistan was not always in the horrible situation it's in now. It was ruled by a king at one time, and then he was overthrown by his cousin, and then the sort of communist allied governments took over, and it was those governments that Brzezinski's great idea came about to support these extreme Islamic rebels against the Soviet's pro-Soviet government. Now, in those days, women were educated. They had a university. It was a poor country, but it was a country that had dignity, and it was sort of on the right track, and it was a humane country. Well, Brzezinski's idea bore fruit. These reactionary jihadis took over. They drove out that government, and so that, in a way, was Brzezinski's version of the Great Game. Now, the original the Great Game goes back about 200 years or more, and it's at one point it was the Brits against the Russians in Afghanistan. And Afghanistan was seen as sort of a gateway to a greater empire, namely the Central Asia. And so that's what the Great Game was. Recently, there's a real good article by Alfred McCoy, and it's called "Washington's Great Game and Why It's Failing." And he goes into this. He starts out talking about what he calls insularity in Washington. And what he means is that the people in Washington, they are so convinced that they are the center of the world that they really don't know or care that much about the rest of the world. And it's here's a little sidelight. This is I guess about a month ago, I talked with James Bradley, who wrote a book called The China Mirage, and about how the U.S. in those days, back in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, they did not understand China at all. They were convinced by missionaries that China wanted to be Christianized and Westernized, and which led them to support this corrupt General Chiang Kai-shek. And this was the greatest, the best and brightest out of the Ivy League universities running Washington. They thought they knew China, but they didn't. They were totally ignorant of China. Well, the same kind of thing is happening now. We have people in Washington. They think they understand what's going on in the Middle East. They think they have the wisdom and the smarts to kind of play one side against the other. And we see that it's really collapsing all around them. You see even this in the news media. You know, one of my contentions is that NPR, or what they do okay. It's what they don't do. And their reporting on a lot of foreign policy issues has been really terrible, especially Ukraine. And I think that part of this is that NPR is based in Washington, D.C. You know, it's they are so close to this, what they conceive of as the world's big power, and they are sort of basking in its glory, and they meet these guys every day, and they are on sort of personal terms with them, and so they tend to adopt this viewpoint. Plus, if they don't adopt that viewpoint, they may not be invited to press conferences. They may not be allowed to ask questions. So anyway, that is what is on the basis of Washington's insularity. So McCoy writes about a British geographer named Halford Mackinder. And keep in mind that he was a geographer. And he had this theory that that this, and he called it Eurasia, and that would this heartland would sort of control the world. And he presented this to, I think, the British Geographical Society over 100 years ago. And he had a new look at the map of the world. And instead of Great Britain being at the center of the world, he had this sort of globe centered on Asia. And he sort of had it Then Southern Asia and Europe and Japan and became sort of what he called the rimlands, the borderlands, and then finally, completely set apart was the Western Hemisphere, the Americas. And Mackinder's idea was that this Euro-Asian heartland was where most of the world's resources and population existed, and that it would wind up controlling the world. It would be the dominant center of the world. Well, for a long time, and James Bradley goes into this in his book, The China Mirage, you know, for hundreds of years, China was the richest nation in the world. And they had their own version of insularity. They thought very highly of themselves. But they were brought down by the Opium Wars in the 1800s. And so for a couple hundred years, China, which had been sort of maybe the dominant power in the world, was one of the weakest powers. And at that same time was when Europe discovered, when they went on their exploring sagas, they sent sailing ships all around. They discovered the Americas. They went around, and they went down into Africa, around Cape Good Hope in Africa, into Asia. So for a couple hundred years, sea power, and at that time Britain was the British Empire was the sea power. They ruled the waves, as they say. And Mackinder thought that in the future, and he's speaking about 100 years ago, that the future would depend on some kind of balance between the sea power and the heartland. And I guess that was his fond hope. But, you know, the heartland was, it didn't depend on sea power. It depended on roads, like the Silk Roads of the Middle Ages. And now it depends on rail lines and all kinds of land-based communications. It doesn't need sea power. But it's been the goal of invaders ever since. World War I and World War II dealt with this heartland. Hitler's try to invade the Russian heartland and take it over for himself, and luckily for all of us, he failed. Although our Washington warlords do not like to admit it, that it was actually the Soviet Union that defeated Hitler and not so much the Allies. After World War II, the U.S. Kind of took over the Russian, over the British Empire. And this is still with Alfred McCoy's article, Washington's Great Game and Why It's Failing. And he says that after World War II, the U.S. kind of controlled not so much the heartland itself, but both ends of it. In other words, the U.S. controlled Europe up to the so-called Iron Curtain, and the U.S. also controlled Japan and South Korea and its allies there. And they've been trying to, from controlling both ends, they've been trying to encircle this heartland and get into it. And so he goes into Operation Cyclone is what they call Brzezinski's idea to arm the Mujahideen against the Soviets in Afghanistan. And what's really interesting to me, kind of horrifying, is that we see now the results of that the Mujahideen came to power. Al-Qaeda was started there and has grown ever since and morphed into all sorts of versions of the jihadism, including ISIS. And we see the devastation that has existed in Afghanistan ever since. I mean, all the people dead, all the people impoverished. And somebody asked Brzezinski about that, and this is what Brzezinski said. And this is a quote. What is more important to the history of the world, the Taliban or the collapse of the Soviet Empire, some stirred-up Muslims, or the liberation of Central Europe and the end of the Cold War? Unquote. That's Brzezinski speaking. That is his mindset. In other words, according to Brzezinski, the liberation of his Polish nation and their allies trumps all the suffering and devastation that was inflicted on Afghanistan and the Middle East. That is, to me, that is seriously disturbed thinking. So that is kind of the way the great game continued. And if you want to comment or ask questions or give us a call, the number is 503-231-8187. Well, what's interesting is that China has kind of arisen from the ashes. In that book, The China Mirage, a big part of the book concerns how China... the forces of Mao Zedong defeated the forces of Chiang Kai-shek and took over China, which was a huge shock to the Washington establishment. It gave rise to this whole question of who lost China, sort of the assumption being that we had China to begin with, but somehow we lost it. And some of the architects of this disastrous policy were actually brought before the Senator McCarthy's committee and vilified for what they did, but for the wrong reasons. But anyway, since then, China has been developing at a kind of steady, sort of chaotic pace, but China now is a number two economy in the world, or perhaps number one for all I know. But China is now kind of resuming its old place as the richest country in the world. And they are joining up. They're forming an economic relationship with Russia to kind of develop this heartland, which, from what I understand, is everything I read, is really giving the Washington establishment fits, if they consider it at all. Some of them, they're still so myopic, they don't even see this happening. But anyway, we have a caller. Joanne is on the air. Good morning, Joanne.
Yeah, hello, Pear. I know I have my own personal problems, but...
Yeah, we all do.
History, past and present, is, to me, overwhelming. I would, at least, if nothing else, they put it, you know, we get it in the schools and that, but we're not... but anyway, I wanted to say this, Pear. Yesterday, your program on Afghanistan, thank you very much. And it was good to hear the professor's reports and that, and some of the callers about Afghanistan. And I wanted to ask yesterday, ask him, was China, Israel, or Saudi Arabia ever involved? And another thing that your lecture was, or talk just today, you mentioned Chiang Kai-shek, and it brings up a little memory of some of the propaganda it probably was that I heard about when I was young. And then you said this, I think you said that, I have a hearing problem too, Heartland, and I'm just thinking, you mentioned that word a couple of times, and I'm thinking about homeland. Is there a similarity in definition? I'll get off the phone, and thank you for listening. Bye.
Well, let's see. I think there were several questions there, but yes, Chiang Kai-shek was he was a darling of Washington back during the war years, and they had he was supportive of what they call the China Lobby, and this was an organization, basically a PR organization. One of its big allies or founders was Henry Luce, who started Time Magazine. And apparently, I think Time Magazine had Chiang Kai-shek on its cover more than anybody else, any other world leader at that time. And the China Lobby is very, very powerful back in the 40s and 50s. And, you know, they were the ones who were peddling this notion that China just yearned to be a Christian nation with the Western economy and all that kind of stuff, which turned out to be false. But they kept peddling this idea anyway. And this is a little bit of a sidebar here, but you know, we talk now about the Israel lobby, you know, AIPAC, and how powerful they are. Well, they are. But they are not uniquely powerful. In some ways, AIPAC reminds me of the old China Lobby. They had Congress really kind of scared, and they had a lot of money, and they were very powerful in their day. And but the China Lobby is kind of, well, I wouldn't say that they disappeared. They just kind of gone into sleep mode or something, or else the people have turned their attention elsewhere. And I just think it's possible that AIPAC, maybe this will happen to AIPAC too. The Zionist lobby may not be as powerful and enduring as a lot of people are afraid of. We got another phone call. Who's that again? Bars is on the line. Hello there.
Hi. I always appreciate your show and your wide-ranging reference work that allows us to get a bigger picture. You were criticizing NPR for being too wrapped up as Washington insiders. I believe that NPR is, we have more hope for them, but all of the media conglomerates everywhere are very dependent on feeding at the trough of power.
That's true, yeah.
And accepting pronouncements and news releases and sound bites as gospel. It's really become terribly disturbing. You know, there isn't hardly any investigative reporting in any of the mainstream media, and what is there tends to shine their light only on very narrow places that, while leaving large areas of the current world dark and unilluminated, like genetically modified food doesn't get very much focus in any kind of mainstream press, and the adventurism of the United States is largely lauded.
Well, the thing about NPR is sort of the best of the bunch, too. I mean, you know, you compare it to CNN and Fox News and all those other outfits, and NPR is kind of, you know, doesn't look that bad. And it gets to a lot of people, they, you know, within that world, they think, well, NPR is the best of the group, and they tend to give it more authority than they deserve.
Well, the non-commercial, quote-unquote, model yeah. Resonates with a lot of people.
That's
and
true, yeah.
The fact that they have news shows that actually talk about world events in a more meaningful way and talk a little less about, you know, bunnies and kittens up trees and silly stuff that passes for news on any of the regular outlets. But as you said, it's not what they cover, but it's what they don't cover. Thanks for your work, and thanks for your show today.
Sure, okay, well, thanks for your call. I might say here that, well, what do we, you know, if even NPR is not the greatest, where do we go for news? Well, we try to provide it here at KBOO, and they try to provide it at Pacifica with all the problems Pacifica Radio is having. But there are other sources, you know. I mean, the internet, if you kind of dig into the internet, you can find all kinds of interesting places to get news. I find I always check out Asia Times every morning. I check out the UK Guardian, although they seem to have been slipping lately. I also go to RT, which used to be Russia Today, and this has got RT has got the State Department tied up in knots, because they put on news shows that are every bit as kind of flashy and worth watching as anything you see on U.S. television, and there's some very interesting stuff there. I particularly go to was a program called Crosstalk, which is host is Peter Lavelle, who's lived in Russia for a long time, and he always has three guests, and he has them sort of go at each other, kind of like a debate, sometimes more of a debate, sometimes less. And he has very interesting guests. Some of his guests have actually been on KBOO, like think of Gareth Porter and Pepe Escobar and a few other people, Stephen Cohen. And another show is called In the Now, and that's the RT's regular evening newscast, and it's on Mondays through Thursdays, and the host there is Anissa Nawe, who actually we got to interview her a few weeks ago, and she presents a news show and always has at least one interview and then the rest of the news, and it's very interesting to watch. Now, RT is definitely presenting things from a kind of a Russian perspective, but what, you know, you combine that, you add that to what we get here with a U.S. perspective, maybe you get a fuller picture, if nothing else. So just to fill out your kind of information banquet here, RT is something to dig into, you know. You won't always agree with it. They also have another host is Sophie Shevardnadze, who interviews people. And she is actually the granddaughter of Eduard Shevardnadze, who used to be, he was in the Soviet, he was a foreign diplomat. He was also the president of Republic of Georgia at one time. And she is his granddaughter. And I guess when she was a teenager, she used to go with him to conferences and things. But she does a very interesting interview. She's a very knowledgeable person. So I would recommend that check out RT. Just go on the internet, type in RT, and you will get it. So those are some of the news sources that that are available. Plus, it's all kinds of other things. There are other things like Information Clearinghouse and Truth Out and a bunch of other stuff. But we have another caller. Mitch is on the line. Hi, Mitch.
Hi, Per. Thanks for the show. And given that you are much more tied in to other media perspectives outside of the U.S. corporate loop, I wanted to get your take on this and see if you are finding any discussion abroad in their media of in 2011 when President Obama passed the KORUS, that's K-O-R-U-S, Korea-U.S. Trade Agreement in 2011.
Oh, no.
That was passed, and in September of last year, the U.S. Congressional House did a report that actually did something our news never does. They do it with sports where there are scoreboards, but they never do it with trade. They don't show a scoreboard. And South Korea has just totally cleaned our clock since 2011. Now, you would think, and I would think, that this would be obvious given that President Obama is now trying to pass an even more massive Asian trade deal, that someone would ask President Obama not about NAFTA, which happened on Clinton's watch and which allows Obama to say, oh, you're just stuck in the past, but that somebody might ask Obama, well, how has your previous Asian trade deal performed, the KORUS?
Oh, okay.
And when I look it up, I find no U.S. news organizations. In 2015 and 2014, the New York Times did a nice job of calling attention to the congressional report showing the degree to which Korea was destroying us thanks to that trade agreement. And I'm just wondering, I'm not prone to conspiracy theories and stuff, but I'm wondering how you can get so many different American news outlets to stay on the page and not ask the most obvious question. And are the Asian journalists talking about the KORUS deal of 2011?
Well, like I said, I do follow Asia Times every day, and I haven't noticed a lot of stuff. I don't stay with it. You know, I just sort of I skim through it. I pick out some articles that look interesting. There's a lot of business news that I haven't explored, but that's very interesting. I don't know that much about KORUS. I'd like to know more about it. It sounds like a something that somebody should ask Obama about.
Well, I'm living out here in Washington County, and today we're supposed to be leafleting and flyering at the Beaverton City Hall, where Suzanne Bonamici, our Washington County version of Earl Blumenauer,
yes,
who talks a great game, and then every time the trade agreements come up, they can't point to a single beneficial outcome for the working class, but they want to position themselves as the working class candidate. And both of them voted for the secret trade deal and the authority to keep it secret in the future.
That's right, yes. The only one who voted no is DeFazio.
And I don't see anybody saying, Ms. Bonamici, KORUS, how did the 2011 Obama Asian trade deal work? I don't see even Jenka, who's on top of things in KBU News, asking about KORUS.
Well, hey, check. Hey, maybe I'll go home and check into this. Gee whiz, I don't know that much about one thing about, you know, actually, this is the day that I guess they're going to be taking a vote on this fast-track thing in Congress today. So that's why a lot of people are leafleting and on the phones and everything else. And one thing about this Trans-Pacific whatever is that it is an attempt to exclude China. It is a trade organization including all the Pacific Rim nations except China.
Well, and this ties into your great game. I mean,
exactly.
What they're doing is they're creating a greater sacrifice zone of the U.S. economy for purposes of some political scientific game that only affects the insiders and the people who keep their money offshore anyway.
Yeah, something like that. And I think some of the nations that we are trying to tie into our group are also dealing with China, too.
So I just wondered if there was any gloating in the Russian press about the degree to which Korea, under the neoliberal model, and this Obama agreement of 2011 has just shifted the more wealth from North America to Korea.
Boy, well, that is you raised a question that's going to be on my mind, and I will.
Can you talk to Jenka and ask the news department at KBOO to look in a chorus and start asking our representatives about it?
Well, first I got to find out more about it myself, and
but
if I see her. Why don't you call her up and leave an email, leave a message on her voicemail.
Listen, I've been emailing stories about Chorus to every journalist I know, and no one responds. So.
Well, I'll tell you why. You can email me anything you get. My email address is Phantom.
Oh, you've been on the list, Pear. So
oh, okay.
I think it's the fact that it's hard to interest not only Americans in trade, it's sometimes hard to interest journalists in trade issues, too.
Well, sometimes hard to figure them out, you know.
That, and I agree with you. Keep doing, though.
Okay, thanks for your call. Well, okay. Gee whiz. Chorus, K-O-R-U-S. I will have to check that out. If anybody else out there has anything to say about that, give us a call at 503-231-8187. Well, we sort of left off where, where China is kind of reestablishing itself as one of the great powers of this world Eurasian heartland, and we might ask, well, what in the last few centuries, what has America been doing? Well, actually, America left, when America got started, the United States, which actually is kind of, America should include the whole entire two continents, North and South, but the United States, left the old world and basically stole the new world, or a good chunk of it. You know, that's sort of the American dream started out to be killing Indians and taking their land. And So for 300 years, we have lived all this immense wealth, this sort of untapped wealth of the Americas. You think of the forests and the fertile land and the oil and all the other minerals and everything else. We've been living off that ever since, and it's made this is what made America wealthy. The wealthiest nation in the world was all this. We kind of succeeded in capturing nature's treasury, and we were happy doing that. The Monroe Doctrine was promulgated by President Monroe to keep other European nations out of our turf. We were going to rule the Americas ourselves and profit off of it. And we felt like Fortress America. We were protected by two oceans. Nobody could really attack us, and we had all this wealth. We didn't need the world. We kind of were the world. We were the center of the world. But then what happened is eventually we had to go beyond our borders. The frontier ended, closed. Then we went across. We stole Hawaii, which actually was a kingdom. And then we went on into the Spanish-American War, gave us Puerto Rico and the Philippines and other places. And so since then, the U.S. has spread out to include, just about a great chunk of the world. And we allied with Europe in colonizing the world. And this kind of, this is a, you know, a thriving enterprise for a couple hundred years until, well, World War One kind of was the beginning of the end for that. You know, think of World War One as a battle between rival empires. You know, you had, you know, the British Empire, the French, the Germans, the Austrians, Russians, and the Ottomans all battling it out. A lot of what they were battling over had to do with Africa, which had been divided up just 30 years before. Well, the World War One really kind of destroyed a lot of these empires. And America picked up the pieces. But now what's happening is that America is running out of resources. You know, at one time, America was the world's great oil producer and exporter. And so this is nature's great gift. You know, millions of years, took millions of years to make that oil, and we kind of squandered it all in just, oh, I don't know, a few decades or something. And so now we have kind of squandered this great wealth. We are very much in debt, and we're living in a nation that is very glitzy on one end. You know, it's like you talk about you know, million-dollar apartments in New York City and San Francisco, while our infrastructure is crumbling. And so we had our chance. We grabbed the pot and we spent it all. And now China is sort of reasserting its place, and they are combining with Russia to create this world heartland that Mackinder was talking about. And so America is feeling very besieged these days, ever since 9/11. That's what that quote from Representative Mac Thornberry was all about. We felt that the thing about 9/11 was not so much the violence and destruction, but the fact that that they could do this right here in New York City. And it's just, we were not used to that. We were not used to having other nations come in and tear up our turf. You know, well, the Brits did it a bit during the War of 1812, but, you know, it's nothing like that. And so America is feeling very besieged. And part of that is because America has expanded. When you keep expanding, there are more places that where the your enemies can besiege you at. You have more points of conflict. You know, we used to feel very safe behind our oceans, but we have gone beyond the oceans. And now that was a big shock of 9/11 was that these people could strike back, and they struck back not because they hated our freedoms. They struck back because they hated what we were doing. And Osama bin Laden was very explicit about that. The thing that drove him up the wall was U.S. foreign troops in the Holy Land of Saudi Arabia, plus all the other troubles that were inflicted on the Middle East by the U.S. and the other imperial nations. And so now they have the means of striking back, and this to me is what a lot of this terror scare is all about. Terrorism, think of terrorism not so much this group or that group, because they keep changing, you know, they morph from one into another. And you know, now the big one is the Islamic State. Think also of terrorism as a tactic. It's a way of fighting a war. And the thing about terrorism is that it works. You know, we have, you know, we like to boast about being the big super military power, the military superpower, put it that way. And but it's very vulnerable. You know, we have this expensive military equipment can get, you know, the costing, you know, some armored personnel carrier, a tank or something costing millions of dollars can get destroyed by a roadside bomb that just costs less than $100. And anybody can create a roadside bomb. It doesn't take any special technical ability. It doesn't take any war contractors. People do it at home, unfortunately. And so that is the that's a terrorizing thing about terrorism, is that it has they have exploited America's vulnerability. And I'm really convinced that this is the big thing that panicked people after 9/11, plus all the interesting things coming out about how the don't even want to get into too much here, is about what did the U.S. know about Bin Laden's intentions, and what did they or did they not do about it? So there's another interesting article that I read. This was this sort of goes in with the Russia and China coming together. And this is an interview with a German banker. And this is in a German newspaper called Deutsche Wirtschaftsnachrichten, which basically means German economic news. And they interviewed a guy named Volker Hellmeyer, who is a chief economist at the Bremer Landesbank. And a couple things that he said that really come to mind is that he said that these sanctions that we have inflicted on Russia, that, you know, we kept hearing, in fact, just this morning on the on NPR, they were talking about how these sanctions have put the Russian economy into a depression. But according to Volker Hellmeyer, that the this is these sanctions have hurt Europe even more than Russia. And of course, maybe the U.S. doesn't care too much about that. You know, the U.S. kind of, you know, we're still safe from a lot of repercussions, but Europe is feeling them pretty badly in many, many ways. And so that's one thing that this German banker said, is that the sanctions are hurting Europe as much as Russia. And he's also saying that this Russia-China alliance is on its way to victory. And he was asked about this conflict, and this is what he said. It's a little short paragraph here. This is the Volker Hellmeyer talking. It says, to me, the conflict has already been decided. The Axis Moscow-Beijing BRIC wins. BRIC means Brazil, Russia, India, and China conglomerate. The Axis Moscow-Beijing BRIC wins. They've had enough of the West. In 1990, these countries accounted for about 25% of the world economic output. Today, they represent 56% of the world economic output and 85% of the world population. They control about 70% of the world's foreign exchange reserves. They grow annually by an average of 4 to 5%. Since the USA were not prepared to share international power, that is, votes in the IMF and the World Bank, the emerging countries build their own financial system. This is the future. Now, this is very interesting. This should be an antidote to this kind of Washington insularity that that McCoy was talking about. You know, we like to think of ourselves as a leader of the self-described international community, but this Russia-China alliance is sort of represents more people, more wealth, than anything that we have on offer. And this German banker is recognizing that and talking about it. So if you want to talk about it, we've got about 10 minutes left on this show. Number to call is 231-8187. We might say a little bit about Russia, you know, especially the war in Ukraine, the news that we get about Ukraine is so one-sided, even on NPR, it's just terrible that it's presented in such a one-sided way that we don't understand what is going on there. But this the sanctions, you know, the ones that the German bankers say are hurting Europe more than they're hurting Russia. Another thing that those sanctions are doing is pushing Russia closer to China. So here we are worried about this sort of Eurasian heartland, but the things we do in the world are just helping to bring it about even more so. This is, you could say, this is kind of one of the supreme ironies of history. Another thing, and this is, there was an article that was, it was in the UK Guardian about a week or two ago by Seamus Milne, and it's titled, "Now the Truth Emerges, How the U.S. Fueled the Rise of ISIS in Syria and Iraq." Okay, we got a call. You're on the air. Mark, you're on the air.
Hey, Per.
Hi, R.
Enjoy your show. But one thing that I don't know whether I should correct you on it or not.
Sure, go ahead.
It's about Osama bin Laden.
Okay.
And I suppose as you're well aware of the fact that days before the 9/11 attack, Osama bin Laden was purportedly at a military hospital in Pakistan receiving kidney dialysis.
I'd heard about that, yes, okay.
And purportedly, there was a well-known major media talking head there to witness that. I forget the guy's name, but at any rate, whether or not Osama bin Laden actually was killed by U.S. forces in 2011, I think is highly debatable, because he may have, by many reports, was already dead in 2001.
That's true. I would like to know more about that. I would like to see it debated more. It's very interesting. I mean, it's people I respect say that bin Laden was dead long before that. But then Al-Qaeda itself admits that, or they say that that bin Laden was killed in 2011. So I don't know. I really don't know. But I'm open to hearing more about it.
Yeah, well, there's numerous things on the Internet about it. For one thing, he put out a video shortly a week or two after 9/11 saying that he didn't do it because it was against the tenets of Islam.
And okay.
This guy being a devout Muslim, probably would want to adhere to the tenets of Islam. So, he did put out this video, but we never saw it. We saw the fake CIA videos with Osama bin Laden bragging about how he was, you know, he figured on bringing down these buildings and all this other stuff, and and it's just a boatload of crap.
Well, it could be.
And then Seymour Hersh presents us with a lie within a lie, which is how this kind of belief of these things becomes firmly entrenched in our consciousness, because when someone comes out and says, well, Osama bin Laden was, some kind of ridiculous talking about how that when the SEALs went in to kill him, that he that they were told to kill him instead of not told to kill him, or whatever it was. The whole thing is just, it's likely that the guy who was making these Osama bin Laden videos was in that compound in Pakistan, and they sent the SEALs in to kill him, And so he'll never be talking about it.
Well, of course, then he supposedly buried him at sea or whatever. The whole thing, there's so much that's just very, very suspicious. But, you know, it's there's a biography of bin Laden, and I interviewed that guy who wrote it. His name is Michael Scheuer, and he's sort of an interesting guy because he's a very, very conservative, reactionary Catholic. But he was in the CIA, and he was a head of the bin Laden team back in the 1990s. And he wrote this biography of bin Laden. And, of course, he sort of hates everything bin Laden did, but he had to admit that bin Laden had a lot of noble qualities that attracted followers to him. Scheuer is still around. Every now and then he's a fervent non-interventionist and, like I said, a very reactionary Catholic. But it's interesting. There's another article I have. It's by a guy named William Engdahl.
Yeah, I've heard of him.
And he wrote an article. It's called What If Putin Is Telling the Truth? And basically, Engdahl is saying, this is what Putin is saying, I guess Engdahl goes along with it, is that what happened in Afghanistan, that after the U.S., succeeded in driving the Soviets out after our so-called, quote, victory in Afghanistan, that we had these, they call them the Afghan Arabs. These were these jihadis who flocked into Afghanistan from outside. Well, what did we do with them? We sent them to go after Russia in other areas in Central Asia, like Chechnya, for one place. And so
that makes a lot of sense.
Yes, this is an amazing article, and it goes into great detail, more detail than I got time to talk about here. But it's in the NEO, the New Eastern Outlook, and it's called What If Putin Is Telling the Truth by F. William Engdahl. So it's really worth reading. It's the whole idea is that the U.S. continued. Brzezinski's great idea went on to more damage and more destruction in Chechnya, and that they are sort of gearing up to maybe have a war in Armenia or who knows elsewhere, you know, that they never stop. And the target is the same. The target is the same target that's been for a long, long time now, is this Asia, Eurasian heartland. So anyway, but...
Well, much of Russia is actually in Asia.
Yes.
East of the Urals. And so it's kind of a natural alliance between China, Russia, and India. Because... let's face it, Anglos and Americans have been messing with those people ever since time immemorial.
That's true. But,
you know, we go to China and you have the Opium Wars. The Brits took over India and they trashed that place. And then, as a parting shot, when they left, they decided that some kind of political science wonks in London decided to cut the country in two, dividing it into Pakistan and India, which is, and the Muslims live in Pakistan and the Hindus live in India. And so we've been messing with those people all around the world for centuries.
That's true, yeah.
How can you think that all this bad karma is not going to come washing back at us sometime or other? Because, the really odious thing about it is that most people don't really haven't studied it, don't know anything about it, trust our leaders. It's none of our place to think about such high important thoughts, because what do we know? But
well, I think that's why a lot of Americans, they thought that 9/11 just literally came out of the blue for no reason at all. And George Bush is saying, well, they hate us for our freedoms. And, people not knowing any better, they tend to believe him, and so they're just shocked and humiliated when this happens to Fortress America, I don't know, what can you do? I guess just keep chugging away at the truth. I mean, that's what KABU is all about.
I got one more thing.
Okay, real quick.
If you look at those videos on 9/11, mm-hmm. and And you see how all that stuff is flying apart and coming apart there. And you have to ask yourself whether or not that's just floors coming down due to gravity.
Well, that's true. I mean, I'm not a structural engineer. I know there are engineers who say what you're saying.
You don't have to be an
engineer. Uh-huh. Well,
you have eyes in your head to see it.
Well, check it out. I'm in favor of checking everything out. So thanks for your call. I hear our music playing, and stay tuned for Air Cascadia.
That's right, Air Cascadia coming up on KBOO, KBOO Portland, your community radio station. In 15 minutes, join us for Flashpoints, a discussion of how Walmart secretly uses tax havens to dodge taxes, and Haitians prepare for more fraudulent elections. We'll hear from Flashpoints reporter Kevin Pina. At 11 on Between the Covers, host Ken Jones talks with author James Anderson, founder of Brightbush Books, about his debut novel, The Never Open Desert Diner. And at 11 on the Radio Zine, host Andrew Geller speaks with veteran environmental journalist and author Fred Pierce, whose latest title is The New Wild, Why Invasive Species Will Be Nature's Salvation. Coming up next, it's Chris Andre hosting Air Cascadia. Headlines, interviews, and commentary. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a current member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate today.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor for ALEC Expo's film screening and workshop on June 18th, 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. ALEC, the American Legislators Exchange Council, is a corporate-directed organization which writes model legislation for state legislatures around the nation that is beneficial to multinational corporations. Secretive corporate-directed and funded organizations like ALEC undermine the principles of citizens participating in democratic processes. ALEC Expos explain how ALEC functions, who is involved, and how to fight back to promote democratic, non-corporate values. Again, that's ALEC Expos, June 18th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church on Southwest 12th and Salmon in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.